Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. We ended last episode at 1545, and we've been covering sort of bigger pieces of history, and that's going to continue today as well. We're probably going to cover five-ish years again this episode. So before we jump into there, I just want to remind everybody that we are part of the 1517 Podcast Network. We have a great lineup of shows there right now. I'm honestly really proud of what we produce every week. We have a daily podcast and the blogcast. So if you aren't a reader of the 1517 blog but are interested in what is happening there and you do listen to podcasts regularly, every day that blog is read as a podcast and published. And those take anywhere between 5 and 7 minutes to get through. So they're not very long, and you could add that to sort of your daily or weekly mix of podcasts. I find them quite enjoyable. In fact, you can listen along while you read on the website, which I actually really enjoyed. I was kind of surprised. I was listening to it and reading it, and I thought it was helpful. And so I would check that out if you're looking for something sort of short and daily. We also have a couple exegetical podcasts. If you know you're interested in diving into the New Testament and the Old Testament deeper, we have 30 minutes in the New Testament and 40 minutes in the Old Testament available. So go check out all of the shows over there. It's certainly the type and the breadth of content is not lacking. So that's, again, 1517.org/podcasts. One other note before we jump into the show. If you are looking for a speaker for your church, you can contact us on the speakers page. It's 1517.org/speakers. If you go on that page, there's a contact and a form you can fill out. If you have a Bible study weekend or just an event at your church that you would like somebody who sort of has a specialized training in apologetics or in the history of the Reformation or in some other topic that you want to cover, you can reach out to us, and we will do our best to see if we can get a speaker out during the dates of your event. And we're always happy to do those. And we're right now, I think 2019 is the books aren't completely closed, but we're mostly scheduled out. But 2020, if you are planning out your next couple of years worth of events or educational things at your church, please do consider our speakers. And if you want to support things like the Speakers Bureau, the podcast network, the videos and things that we do, there's a donate button up on the 1517 website, and we would ask that you do please consider supporting what we do here and our goal to proclaim the gospel of Christ crucified every day. All right, so we're going to jump into what's going to become sort of an era of turmoil for Lutheranism. But before that, we had a listener ask me the other day via email, hey, are you guys going to talk about the Council of Trent at all? And it just so happens that 1545 is the opening of the Council of Trent. And so we are going to take a minute to sort of talk about what the Council of Trent is. We may have listeners who are not even familiar with what the Council of Trent is.
Yeah, highly, highly significant, because it was the first time that Rome went down on paper as to what they held and what they condemned. But it's down on paper.
Adam, could you talk about the difference between a council and a diet? We've had several diets show up between official meetings of the church with the Protestants.
A diet's a political affair. You know, it's a Reichstag. It's a meeting of the electors and all the princes of Germany. And whereas a council can be a whole bunch of things. But in this case, it's a church council. Routine throughout the Middle Ages, even beyond or before the Middle Ages. This is not an ecumenical council, though. You know, there aren't representatives from the East or anything like that. But as Dr. Rosenblatt just said, what's significant historically with the Council of Trent, to add to what he already said, is that in the Middle Ages, there are heretics, recognized heretics, from the stand or the perspective of the papacy. But now, even into the late Middle Ages, there's still kind of I don't know how to put it. They put up with differences of opinion, if you will, within the church. And then at the Council of Trent, we all of a sudden have like an official formula of what Roman Catholicism is, where they put themselves down on paper as, if in terms of the doctrine of justification, as enemies of the doctrine of justification by grace through faith on account of Christ alone.
So, Adam, kind of half as a question. This was...
Well, I've got to throw in a quote here from Dr. Horton. At Trent, Rome anathematized the gospel.
Well, indeed.
It is certainly not friendly, no.
Well, that was kind of disappointing to the Lutherans in general. Again, we've talked about several times in this series how they wanted the opportunity to have a council and to ask, you know, to have a hearing and a council and have a council decide on these issues. They weren't even really invited, though, were they?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Memory serves me correctly.
And I think later, because the council lasts a long time. I mean, the listeners...
2+ years, yeah.
They spoke of one being held at Mantua, but it never came to pass.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, wasn't it held... I think it was held... wasn't it held for more than like 15 years, the Council of Trent, before the decision, before the,
oh, yeah,
the
yeah,
canons
yeah, yeah,
of decrees yeah, are released yeah, in yeah, the 60s?
Yeah.
So this is,
I think the bulk of it is 1545 to 1547, yeah. But yeah, it takes a while for it all to be...
All to be released and everything.
And basically, you know, people talk of echo chambers. That's kind of what it was.
Okay.
A meeting of Catholic theologians who are not necessarily... I mean, this is, of course, coming from a Lutheran's perspective, but they're not there necessarily to approach what the doctrines of the church are in an aloof manner, but it's primarily a response to the challenges of Protestantism, in particular Lutheran theology. So it's kind of a polemical council to, you know, marginalize or to ensure, I mean, to guarantee that the Lutherans and other Protestants will be considered outside the fold of the church.
Yep.
So it's set up to begin with, I'd argue.
Is there, I mean, just to play devil's advocate, is there anything positive to say about the Council of Trent? Just...
Well, yeah, I think it says a lot that finally they're down on paper as to what they hold. That's a first.
I mean, that was one of the problems at Augsburg, too, was sort of the sweeping rejection without specifying until the confutation. Mm. But I have been... So I've heard a critique of people that up until the Council of Trent that... and maybe even after some people have said this, that they were never... That the errors that the Lutherans... accused them of were never officially done by councils. It was all individuals who were the problem. It was all individuals. And the councils and the church never actually signed on to those errors.
The one I've heard from priests is, yes, we all signed to it and ignore it for the rest of our lives.
Sounds about right.
Okay, cool. Well, I think moving on then. Moving on. So 1546... is sort of an emotional year. Luther preaches his last sermon and dies not the same day, but very shortly after, like only like three or four days later.
Later, yeah.
And he's in Wittenberg, but not everybody's there, right? So he died. Who's around him when he dies?
He's in Eisleben, where he's born. Yeah,
okay.
He's down there mediating some dispute between nobility, and I mean, I think
did he travel while sick or?
I mean, he was for his last 20 years, I think,
perpetually ill,
always sick with something, whether it's stones. I don't know if they're kidney or
gout
or what, or
heart attacks.
Heart attacks. I think ultimately he died of a stroke. Right? Am I correct? Well, maybe the verdict's out.
Yeah. A stroke or a heart attack.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So he
I've heard it said his heart exploded.
Yeah.
But I've also seen that it was a stroke. But that's February 18th of 1546, surrounded by friends. I think it was like 3 a.m. It was very early in the morning. Eustace Jonas was there, Bugenhagen, and all his friends. And he was even asked, and they know he's going. And you mentioned it's a very emotional year. Mm-hmm. You read the stuff of Luther's last hours. It's hard, especially if you have some affection towards him, it's moving how confident he was.
Yep.
I mean, one description says when he's asked, "Are you ready to go?" and he just says, Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's it.
Or do you want to change your confession at all?
Right. Nine.
Nine.
I think it's important to note that there's a, is it 4 years earlier, Adam, that his daughter dies?
Yeah.
Magdalena.
Magdalena dies. And that was a...
In his arms.
That was a...
I think that broke his heart.
That's a break point for him, too. There's a lot of wind that goes out of his sails after that point. And he, there's several letters, I think even in the American edition in English, where he writes regarding how difficult her death was.
Yeah.
And even some correspondence regarding the conversations that they had as she was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And there's... I can't even imagine that. I mean, it's... Mm-hmm. So 4 years later, when he asks, "Are you ready to go?" and he says, "Yeah," some of that's not too surprising to me. Once he's
sort of heartbroken,
so much has gone on, you know, so much turmoil. He's been so sick. His daughter dies. His beloved daughter dies. You know, 4 years prior to that, breaks his heart. He's seen his Bible published. You know, and I think that's huge for him. So.
And then, as I've been doing some research for a chapter we're doing together, it's interesting. So Melanchthon preaches at his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Which
he sure does.
Some people are surprised about, because he had closer personal friends than Melanchthon. But Melanchthon... Yes. Melanchthon ends up preaching, which is also sort of an interesting point, because Melanchthon's never called to a particular congregation, right? But in this instance, he preaches it. Is there anything else significant about that, besides that we see Melanchthon, who's usually the teacher, taking up the role of preacher, which is what, if you look at the contrast between Luther and Melanchthon, you'd say the teacher and the preacher, right? And Melanchthon sort of takes up that mantle for a day?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have time, and I actually don't have the inclination to get into trouble to talk about it that much. But Timothy Wanger suggests that our view of Melanchthon as a layman is completely inaccurate. There would have been Wanger argues that there would have been a category for Melanchthon as clergy in that day and age, even though he wasn't a normal preacher in a congregation. And so we actually don't know how common or rare it would have been for Melanchthon to be in that pulpit. We know that it's not his regular call.
Sure.
But we also don't know that it was unheard of for him to step into that pulpit. There's no evidence to this at all, but it is interesting that Cranach's painting on the altarpiece at the Castle Church of Wittenberg shows Melanchthon in what we would commonly call a pastoral role, baptizing a baby. So we, you know, there's some of that that we have to be careful that we're not taking sort of our modern approach to the call and to the office of the ministry and imposing it back onto them.
Always a good historical a priori.
Yeah. So, and some of this is just the reality. We don't know it all. Sort of the systems are not, I mean, there's probably written somewhere, but that's not all been translated, you know, and that's not, and there's been some research done on it. Wangard, I think, has done some extensive research on it. And he is convinced that we don't see this accurately.
Okay.
So I think the more interesting thing is there's an article by named James Michael Weiss called Erasmus at Luther's Funeral, where he argues that Melanchthon's funeral oration at Luther's funeral might as well have been Erasmus, for how much Melanchthon chastises Luther.
Oh my gosh!
In his funeral oration, it's an interesting relationship those two had. You know, sort of a lot of this stuff that we talked about in the last episode that Melanchthon is frustrated with Luther over regarding how he treated people comes out at his funeral.
Were there several orations at his funeral?
I think there was more than one.
Bugenhagen.
Yeah, Bugenhagen.
Will
too.
Get delivered
and
one
Jonas
as well.
Too. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jonas, I think, was the pastor who attended him as he's dying.
That's correct. Yeah. Yep. I think it's fair to say he's Luther's pastor.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right. So, I mean, I don't want to move past it too quickly, but we're getting now into stuff we've talked about on past shows, which is the fallout that this causes. Obviously, when the like, you don't want to say, "Hey, Lutheranism is dependent on Luther," because it's mm-hmm. it's not really right mm-hmm. because it is a confession of faith that was contributed to and written by many
yep.
people. But it does cause, outside of sort of that, like Adam said, reading it, the emotional turmoil, it actually causes some sort of issues as far as the order and practice of Lutheranism. The figurehead mm-hmm. is sort of gone. And we've talked in the past about how that mantle sort of gets automatically assigned to Melanchthon, and Melanchthon sort of maybe doesn't know exactly what to do.
Well, it's hard. I think, and Adam's probably more helpful on this than I would, but it's interesting to say that there's not a mantle, because I think we would like to think that there isn't, right? That it's not as easy as Luther dies and now sort of the head is gone, what do we do? But it really seems like that's the case. It seems like even if it's only by means of perception, that the entire world that knows and is influenced by this Reformation knows that once Luther is dead, something's wrong, and that there's opportunity, and that there's maybe no real leader here anymore. I think from what I've read of Melanchthon and some correspondence, he does feel this burden, and he doesn't. He also, I think, to a degree, knows that it's not the right burden for him, and that he's not going to be able to fill these shoes in the same way. But he's, you know, and there's times, and I assume we'll talk about it as we talk about the interims, where he tries, and he ultimately, every time he tries, he fails rather miserably at it, and I think he knows this. So, do you think there's an actual mantle being passed here?
I don't, not an actual mantle, but I think just in any, I don't want to call it this, but movement, you're going to have those figures who people follow, those leaders.
Yeah.
And I think Melanchthon's the heir apparent.
Yes.
I think, and there's a reason why he's called a preceptor of Germany.
Yeah.
Because he's the one who's going to, he's going to be the great, I mean, he's already the systematizer of if you will, Lutheran theology, but it becomes even more the case, and the system is even bigger now after Luther's gone, as Melanchthon considers more, you know, civil matters, domestic matters in the next, I don't know how much longer, 10 more years.
Melanchthon lives another almost 15.
15.
It's 14. But.
What's the date of Luther's death as compared with the publication of the Book of Concord?
Well, it's Luther's 1546. Book of Concord is published 1580.
Okay.
And so, but I mean, I always say Book of Concord, you have to kind of take the period between 1577 and 1580 and sort of call it a process.
Mm.
Because you have the sort of the initial writings of the formula going on 1577, 1578.
Okay.
Then 1579, 1580, you get the actual compilation of the Book of Concord with its publication in 1580.
So we've talked about the interims on, I think we did a Q&A. It was maybe the last Q&A we did last year where somebody asked a question about Melanchthon and the Augsburg interim and the Leipzig interim. And I think we only spent like 10 minutes on it, so it's probably good to sort of elaborate, because this is sort of going to be the first like doctrinal / political move Melanchthon makes after this mantle.
Well, there's a whole something important that happens in between here.
called
the Schmalkaldic War.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't last that long, so it's in historical terms, it's a bit of a blip, I think. Was 2 weeks or something like that, Adam?
Mm-hmm.
The Schmalkaldic League is basically the emperor, and with with funds given by the Pope, I believe, is able to now take an army and march north.
Yeah. Well, I think it's even conceived by the papacy to be a crusade.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting to me reading sort of letters early, like 10 years earlier, letters from Melanchthon and Luther, the correspondence is, this is Melanchthon's worst nightmare realized.
Well, that's the way to think of this, right? Luther's dead. This is everybody's worst nightmare realized, to be honest with you. The only thing that could be worse for the Lutherans, I think, would be if the Turks were to come in. I mean, that might be worse, but they're probably not sure at this point.
Yeah.
Melanchthon's world is the university, first of all, and he is devastated when at the end of the Smalcaldic War, basically the University of Wittenberg is shut down. That's a devastating thing to him because that is his world. And so that's what happens. I mean, the armies come up, the Smalcaldic League, which we've talked about in previous episodes, tries to defend the region. I mean, it's kind of hard to say. The regions, the Lutheran regions, there are some holdouts. Magdeburg manages to hold out, which is where you get the Gnasios that come basically from Magdeburg because they're holding out. They're not conquered. Some other areas hold out, but most fall to the emperor's army and to the Pope's army.
Is that Magdeburg is where Flaccius is at this point? So he sort of made the right call when he moved 7 years later.
And so with all of that going on, you know, what the interim is after the Lutheran lands are defeated, the interim is literally a document, a confessional style document that mandates what the religious practice will be in these lands. And it's called the interim. It's originally the first one is the Augsburg interim. It's called the interim because it's a decision before the decision made, final decisions will be made by the Council of Trent, which is just convening. So it's the decision for the interim period, this
in between
time. Mm-hmm. That's why they're called the interims. The first one, the Augsburg interim, I mean, really nobody likes. it's just not a good solution, which is why you get two interims in 1 year, right? Two interim documents in 1 year. Nobody likes this. It's this sort of seems to be the papist MO. It's hastily prepared. It's not well thought out. How will we enforce this? I think the thinking is that it'll be sort of easy to enforce on the pastors and the rulers because they're defeated. But what they find is that it's very difficult to enforce the practices of the interim with the people.
You'd think after, like, what are we talking now, 30-something years of just showing up with hastily formed documents and the Lutherans just, like, shredding them to bits, that you'd finally at some point be like, all right, we spent a couple weeks on this thing, you know? Just still that same...
No, and in fact, even at this point, Melanchthon, who's, I'd say, quasi out of the picture. I wouldn't say like full exile, but quasi out of the picture. He writes pretty vehemently against the Augsburg interim. I always think it's funny when people of our day will say that Melanchthon was on board with both of them. That's just not the case. I mean, he writes against the Augsburg interim pretty thoroughly. But he's later in that same year, he's persuaded to participate in the writing of what'll be a better, in his mind, a better interim document. Mm-hmm. So later in 1548, he's convinced that if he can come in and if he can help put something together that can actually be practiced and can actually protect the gospel, that things will get back moving again, that the university can be opened up again and that they can start getting students again and that churches will reopen. And he's convinced that this will be the case. And so he participates in it. He's not the only author, but he is, I would say, if anybody's like Adam talks about editing a volume, or you talk about editing a volume, he's kind of the editor of this volume, right? So that he does write some of what's in there, and other people write some of what's in there, but his main role is like an editor of this thing, kind of taking it, rearranging words, rearranging phrases to make them more acceptable by both sides. I mean, just stuff that he's actually pretty good at.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when you do that in modern times, even though you ask other people to write sections, you put your... The editor should really be editing, because at the end of the day, you put your seal of sort of approval.
Well, and his name gets intimately attached to this, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing that he does not do well is he does not consider what the reaction will be from the holdouts. So does that make any sense? So there are all these... There are these holdouts, specifically those that are in Magdeburg, this whole free city that held out, where there are now several prominent Lutheran theologians who get a hold of this interim, and they basically call it synergism. They call him a synergist for participating. That's somebody who promotes that we cooperate in our salvation. That this is his theology. They go back and find evidence in prior versions of the Loci that this has been his theology all along. And I mean, it's a pile on, it's a pile on, it's a pile on. It's
well, and then we've talked about too, that's where some people will cite his disapproval of the bondage of the will.
Right. So this literally, his participation in this becomes the biggest mistake of his life. The church historian Schaff, in his introduction on Creeds and Confessions of the Church, says that this is the mistake of Melanchthon's life, though it's one of the most well-intentioned mistakes a person could make. Because really, he's trying to get pastors back in their jobs. He's trying to get people back in their homes, mm-hmm. students back in the universities.
Sure.
He's trying to get society
functioning
again in some way. And there is just no relief for him after this. Literally, after 1548, there's no relief for Melanchthon because of this document.
And following that, too, there's going to be sort of public controversy, right? So we have a couple... The third use of law argument comes back up again after this. Arguments over adiaphora and particularly the way we worship... And the way worship is done in Lutheran churches is now pretty contentious, because you have now two areas, right? People who were defeated at Smalcald and Magdeburg, the Gnasios, right?
Well, yeah. So I mean, that's
and that actually is gonna. I don't know. I feel like we're still feeling the effects of some of that in Lutheranism today.
Well, we sure are. I mean, the argument becomes here. So Melanchthon gives on matters of religious practice. Okay, so this is what he claims all along. He claims all along that where I gave in the Leipzig interim is I gave on religious matters of religious practice that did not affect the gospel, and for those matters of religious practice which do not affect the gospel, he says those matters are adiaphora and or indifferent. In other words, we could practice them, we could not practice them, and our practicing or not practicing would not influence the proclamation of the gospel or the right administration of the sacraments. Okay? So he says we give on these issues. What the Gnasios argue is that the matters in which he gave some concessions are indeed not adiaphora because they do infringe on the proclamation of the gospel. And the argument become centered around, if I am participating in a practice that that makes me appear as though I agree with the enemies of the gospel, at this point, the papists, are those matters then adiaphora? So if I am practicing the exact same practice, say, concerning how the words of institution are done in the supper, would be a very good example. Okay. Like one of the issues was over the phraxiaponist, literal breaking of the bread,
mm-hmm.
and the elevating of the host, and the literal physical breaking of the bread, which in Roman Catholic theology symbolizes the moment that the priest is re-sacrificing Christ.
Yep.
Right?
They'll deny it, but it's in their books.
Yeah. So within Lutheranism at this time, that practice is eliminated because we don't have that same theology regarding is Christ being re-sacrificed or not. We say, of course he's not, right? This is... Sacrifice once for all. Right.
Yep.
So allowing that back in to the Gnasios is not adiaphora, because in doing so, you're tacitly at least agreeing with the theology of the re-sacrifice of Christ. Does that make sense?
And yep, so, yep, sure does.
While Melanchthon would say, well, actually, you know, I've heard this argument today regarding the fractio pons. Well, 99% of people don't know what is meant when somebody does that. They just like the symbolism of it. You know,
yep.
Melanchthon would make that argument.
Yeah, yep. You literally, the symbolism of the words break bread.
Right.
Yeah.
They would then in turn say, well, no, though. The papists are doing that for a reason.
Yep.
And because they're doing it for a reason, you cannot do it even if you are not doing it for that same reason, because it makes it look like you agree with the reasons they're doing it. And this becomes the literally, people, when we hear this today, you know, 500 years later,
sure,
that this like war of words becomes the atomic bomb that breaks up Lutheranism for 40 years.
Yep.
Well, I mean,
they can't believe it, but it's true.
You could change it today. You could say, you know, a guitar or an organ in the church service, and you'll have people say, well, you can't have, say, screens and lights in a church, not because screens and lights are inherently evil, but because the reasons that mega churches have screens and lights are evil, and now you're going to look like them. And that kind of thing, those are just arguments that we're dealing with to this day.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, and this is supposedly, and I say supposedly, but you could say that it was settled in the Formula of Concord. Article 10 on church rights or on matters that are or not adiaphora, where Article 10 then specifically says, and it's Article 10 of the formula is good to read in this area, because you'll get a couple of things. Article 10 sort of reevaluates what the status of the controversy is. It actually says, this is what, and this is in the epitome. Article 10 literally says this is what the controversy is,
mm-hmm.
And this is sort of why the controversy is actually a big deal, even though it might seem like it's not a big deal, and this is the reality. And Article 10 and the formula falls on the side of not participating in practices that make you appear as though you are in theological agreement with those with whom you have serious disagreement.
Yep.
So it is used in our time to argue against, say, like contemporary worship or the whole nine yards, right? The interesting thing is that the problem with that in our day as a modern argument, that sword cuts both ways.
Yeah.
So you have, obviously with this kind of thing, you have to be careful, because you could cut off your nose to spite your face, which is exactly what happened to Melanchthon.
Well, and one of the interesting differences between, say, something like the fractio pons and contemporary worship is, one you're saying is representative of a Christological error, and the other one is maybe just wrong practice for pop culture reasons or something like that, where it's not saying, you're not saying lights and a drum are a Christological error.
Right, right.
And that might be where some of the distinctions and conversations like this are helpful.
Well, for you brought up, and then we should probably stop because it's probably getting a little bit too much into the weeds, but you brought up Flaccius.
Yeah.
I mean, Flaccius goes as far as to argue against the wearing of Roman vestments, which, you know, so investments for the listeners are the robes that pastors wear or don't wear.
Albs, chasubles.
Mm-hmm.
Copes specifically is what he argues against.
Yeah, regalia of bishops and things like that as well. So
it goes deep. I mean, it goes excessive candelabra. I mean, it's so Melanchthon later apologizes for his role in the Leipzig interim as in an attempt to get these guys off his back.
The Gymnasios.
Sure. Yeah. I don't necessarily think he's, you know, really sorry for it, but I think he's really sorry about what's happened since he did it.
Sure.
It's interesting. We've talked about this off when we're not recording, about how the Gymnasios, like real or true authentic, Lutheran, authentic Lutheran, and Philippists are the ones who are more
flexible.
But in terms of, like, they're more liturgical in this.
Yeah, they're more
context.
Romanish in this context.
So how odd it is, at least this is insider baseball, I think is the phrase now, but how the those were hyper liturgical or more.
They call themselves Phanasios, even though in this context they probably would have been identified more with Philip.
Just for people who that might have gone over their head, we're saying in modern Lutheranism, people who would self-proclaim that they are Gnasios, their worship practices tend to look more like what Philippists during the Reformation actually looked like. Mm-hmm. And so, at some point, not their doctrine switched, but the way in which their worship services looked like switched.
Yeah.
If anybody cares,
if
they probably shouldn't.
But some of the Lutherans who are, visit lots of different churches and see lots of different things might help explain some of that.
Yeah, good point. There's a long history.
I think it's undeniable that many of the practices that we practice today, that from the outside in look very similar to Roman Catholicism, made their way back in during this time and kind of stuck to some degree. Now that's not all bad, because there are many parts of that liturgical service that it's incredibly beneficial. And so we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, which was the deal with Lutheranism all along. But some of the appearance stuff, the stuff that from the outside looks similar.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that, there's also a history, I think, in American Lutheranism of co-opting Anglican practices early on just because English resources when we were still working in German.
We have a mixed audience of listeners. So some people, non-Lutherans may find this interesting just because I have talked to people who... say are evangelical their whole life, and if you say, and they ask, hey, what are you, and you say you're Lutheran, they go, oh, that's mostly Roman Catholic, right?
Sure.
Or some people ask, you were one of the first churches to ordain women, right? Because they
think it's either or. It's either the extreme.
It's both the extremes. Yeah, yeah. Whereas I think if you go to a lot of different Lutheran churches, you'll find they probably look, if you go to a service, look more like your sort of... middle of the way Anglican church. I think I do sort of agree with that. There is some sort of similarity there.
Well, and that's what we haven't gotten into it too much, but that's where the Church of England ends up. It's literally called the middle way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the idea.
Yeah.
Between
Rome and
Anglicanism. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing. So that goes the other way. So within the reform of the liturgy in England, the question is how much can we keep? Mm-hmm. Not what do we have to get rid of? You know, they're really asking how much can we keep? And I think they find that they can keep most of it.
Yeah.
And to contrast again, just because I want to stay broad, and Rod would be able to attest to this, that's very different than the question the Calvinists are asking right now. During the same time period, they're shedding off
Use music?
Yeah.
Yep.
And new hymns?
Yeah. And is that still a big contrast between us? If you walked into
you can see it in architecture. from the real Reformed, you have that principle, the regulative principle, that you don't use anything that isn't first commanded or recommended in Scripture text. And that's not Lutherans. Yeah. We'll say if it doesn't go against the gospel, go ahead and use it. Not just pipe organs, but trumpets and harps and you name it. And to somebody who's truly reformed, that just makes their head spin.
But there's got to be a limit to that, right? I mean, they still have pews, for instance.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, but they're talking about what you see up front, whether there are candles or not,
mm-hmm.
whether your hymns come from your own writers, all that kind of thing, and it's very serious to them.
As opposed to just from the Psalms.
Yep.
Say.
Yeah. Yep. The Dr. Godfrey, it comes from a little group within the Reformed camp that would recommend that we do nothing but sing the Psalms a cappella every single Sunday.
Mm.
That's it. The Psalms are your hymnal, period.
And now we talked about... So that's in sort of Orthodox Calvinism too. It was also in Zwingli. early on. And so that's one of those areas where not all, clearly not all aspects of theology between sort of Orthodox, Reformed, and evangelical world mix, because their worship practice, while they might have ditched some things because of the regulative principle, worship is very different, right? It is, at least that's where we would see what we call contemporary worship hopping out, which is not, it is not just the Psalms being quite
right. Boy, is it ever not just the Psalms.
So that's kind of interesting. I like seeing how sort of the splits in the Reformation and the philosophy behind adiaphora could sort of let listeners of all backgrounds listening to the show go to their church on Sunday and look at what's happening in the service and say, oh, this didn't just come about. There's a history to this. And it's actually a lot of the history of the reasons our churches look different. Maybe all of it stems from the Reformation.
Yeah, and in it you see before your eyes that Luther was not a revolutionary. In other words, when he was watching what was happening at the time, he said, we will keep whatever we can from the historic church that isn't against the gospel. Now, most evangelical churches will look to a founder and leader as if there was nothing that preceded, as if for the first time in how many centuries...
The Bible is read clearly.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Lutherans, we changed the order in which tradition influences doctrine. We call it magisterial or ministerial
use of reason.
And tradition, and you can throw lots of different categories in there, but we don't ditch tradition entirely. In fact, if you look at our confessional documents, we very much look back at people who taught the faith before us to see how were the scriptures read, what is the common thread through the New Testament to today, and I think there's something important about doing that for today still, and not just stopping at 1530 and saying it's all good, or 1572 and saying it's all good. Nothing new happened since the late 1500s.
I think this is an interesting period in Lutheranism, even if the listeners kind of breezed out during some of that, because what you see is after the death of Luther and the Small Caldic War, it becomes very difficult to get Lutherans back together on the same page.
Yep.
And so in a lot of ways, Lutheran history for the next 40 years is sort of the controversies that occur now. So 1538 to 1580, the controversies that occur then during that time period are just there's so many of them. And then that's what really culminates in the Formula of Concord and the Book of Concord. It's an attempt to try to get these now disparate groups back together.
We only have like a minute or two, and so maybe this question—you can tell me if this question is too broad, but it comes to mind. So during the I think I forgot to mention it, but during the last couple episodes, various Scandinavian countries have become Lutheran. Mm-hmm. Now they're not as impacted by this sort of imperial threat in the Small Caldic Battle War, whatever you want to call it. Do you think that's part of the reason that some of the controversy that gets covered in the Formula of Concord later, they're like, yeah, we don't really need to deal with the formula.
I mean, that's, well, there's reasons for it. I forgot the name of the king, but the Swedish king also didn't like it, and so he didn't require it for subscription. In fact, said you can't. I mean, that really, and at that time, I think the Swedish king was king of Sweden and Norway and perhaps Finland. And so that's a big reason. But beyond that, they did not, the Scandinavian Lutherans did not have as much of this going on as did sort of Germany, Saxony, after the Small Caldic War.
They're looking south and going, whoa, those Germans are having a rough time.
Well, they have a very
different
history.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not Christianized until, let's say, for around about year 1000, whereas the rest of continental Europe, France, Germany, and the rest of them there, they've been since the 500, for 500 years prior, they're Christianized, and so.
And this is only been like 400.
The Norselanders, the Northmen, are, you know, they would, their history works out differently. So it's understandable why the controversy down south of them is. They look at it, wondering what the heck's going on down there.
Yeah.
And their Viking stock too.
Yeah.
Both of these, the Leipzig and the Augsburg Interim, are available in the Kolb Nestegen Sources and Context of the Book of Concord.
Okay.
The Augsburg Interim, I know, is translated by Oliver Olson. I think he might have done Leipzig Interim too, but I'm not sure. But the Augsburg Interim is a very good translation, and it's very easy to read. So I'd say if people want to know what's actually going on in there, take a look at it. That's a worthwhile book.
Okay, I'll put those resources in the show notes. Hey, thank you for listening to this episode. Thanks for hanging on with us. If you are not Lutheran through some of the insider stuff, but I do hope it is helpful for people, and maybe you will this Sunday when you go to church, look in and say, hey, some of what I'm seeing here was definitely influenced by this history that I've been listening to.
Don't do that, and don't blame me, and don't get me into trouble.
Well, I'm saying non-Lutherans.
You can do it, just don't get worked up about it.
Yeah, just don't.
And don't be surprised if you see candles and the pastor in funny robes. Expect it.
Yeah, and again, just for reiteration, because Scott doesn't want to get in trouble here, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a lot of that. I'm just saying that we are not often good students of history about how we ended up where we are with some of these practices. Yeah. And that there was not tons of unified practice on this stuff always. And that some of this made its way in because of our history. And part of our history is being a conquered people for a period of time after the Reformation. Hope that clarifies enough.
I think it does. I think it's good. And I don't think... at least the way I've heard it, I don't think we presented this negatively even when it came to traditions outside of our own. So hey, if you have questions about stuff we've done in the series, I've gotten a couple were too technical to do on the show, but I've been responding to emails too. So if you do have questions about various pieces of history, feel free to email us. We'll try to get to them either on the show or via email. You can subscribe to The Thinking Fellows on your favorite podcasting app if you've been listening to this online, or maybe this is your first time hearing the show just because of a search on a podcasting app. Please do give us a subscribe and a rating. It really helps a lot in our searchability and our ability to continue doing this show. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye.